Big birthday for a beloved rock star from Jersey, correspondent Allison Keys.
Fans and family are celebrating the 75th birthday of Bruce Springsteen. You know his hits, including Born in the USA, Dancing in the Dark, and I'm on Fire. Springsteen has sold more than 150 million records worldwide, and he's ranked the 24th greatest of all-time artist by Billboard. Billboard has also certified multiple albums, Diamond in the U.S., for selling over 10 million copies, including his live recording, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band Live, 1975-85. Allison Keys, CBS News.
Are you a fan?
Yes, I'd say I was. I've never seen him live, but yeah.
I saw him at Rensselaer Field, and I saw him at the Meadowlands. I never was a fan growing up, but as an adult, I came to appreciate him maybe from college on, and his concerts are fantastic.
I know. I've heard, you know, I've one of the artists among several that I never got a chance to, well, I had a chance, but I just never did see throughout my career.
Yeah, there's some. I'm not a huge concert goer, but I did. I saw him. I don't feel the need to say. I know people who like have seen him like 10, 15 plus times.
Like the Dead.
I don't feel like I need to see him again. You know, I saw him twice. I'm happy.
I was like with the Stones. I saw the Stones on Steel Wheels in '89, and I'm good.
I remember that show.
It's a Chase Stadium. Well, I went saw him at Chase Stadium.
Shea Stadium. That must have been a good show, though. Thank you.
It was crazy.
Crazy back in the John Silva crazy days. Thank you, John. All right, thank you, Bob. Appreciate that, as always. Coming up in about 10 minutes, Allison Cross from the Hartford Current will talk about vaping in schools and what's being done to try to rein that in. I think there's been so much focus on the phones that we haven't focused enough on that part of our world. And then at 8:50, we'll have Greg Bordenaro of the Hartford Business Journal. I did want to do a quick postscript on last Friday, you know, when we were in Morris, Connecticut, and the Penny Farthing Tea Room and Bakery, and those three women were so great. And I think if you're in that area, and again, me, you know, this time of year, it'd be nice too, this outdoor seating, but like they literally, if you get tea, they bring it out to you in their china with like tea. I mean, it's not like you're getting a cup of tea and even just like a pottery teacup, like it's china. And I mean, to see people visiting with each other with a full pot of tea and then their cups, it was delightful. And then I brought some of the baked goods home to some of my wife's colleagues, and the stuff was amazing. So I just want to thank everybody there and in Morris. We had such a wonderful day, and the Darting Across Connecticut. When are we up with the next? Well, we're gonna post a video when? Next week, next Monday, or this week?
Well, because we're going back to Suffield. So the video's already out, we're going to go back.
We have to get on that. I actually got a text from the Historical Society over the weekend.
Oh, okay.
So, and that's going to be not this Friday, but October 4th.
Correct.
And we have a place, too.
Yeah. Yes. The Barista Cafe?
Yeah.
Cafe Barista?
It's one of those two. I think they use it both ways.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be great that they've
The boss loves it.
Yeah. Yeah. She shows up when she likes the place. Like, she was, she loved the place. She drove all the way to Morris from Anfield.
I went to the Bella or DeLuna Gifts next door. And
they were great, too.
Her and her friend have like a whole week planned up there now. They're going to get some tea. They're going to get some scones. They're going to get chocolate. They're going to get ice cream at Arthus. Like, they're planning a whole weekend.
And we didn't even talk about the wedding venue across the way, that South Farms.
Oh, South Farms, another beautiful place.
We didn't have them on, but that's a great spot, too. And I used to remember going to the farmer's market there. But anyway, we want to thank them, and we'll definitely be back. I do want to touch on, you know, Donald Trump said he's definitely not selling his shares in DJT. Now, this company that he owns, I don't know, roughly 60% of, has gone from like $66 a share in March to now it's going to open at like $13.60. And the company itself is now about $2.7 billion. So his share of it is about $1.5 billion. And we won't know in the moment whether he sells or sold or not. You usually find that stuff out later with filings. And so I don't think it would be possible for him to just dump all the stock on the market, because I think that based on his percentage of shares he has 114 million shares. He would tank the stock. But you wonder if and when and how he's going to sell. We will find out after the fact. But it's a pretty stunning move in a company that truly has no real value. I mean, I think its revenue is not even over $1 million. And I mean, they're losing like their revenue is 3.7 million, excuse me, but their losses are like, you know, 70, 80, $90 million. I mean, they don't make any money. They lose tons of it. And so I'd be really interested to see what happens, because that would constitute like half of his net worth if it stays at the current value, but it's been cut, you know, by what, 4 times? So it was worth a lot more 6 months ago.
Broadcasting from the Johnson Brunetti Studios, this is Brian and Company on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Quick peek at that forecast before we get to Allison Cross of the Hartford Courant. Today, partly sunny, near 70. It's cool outside for sure. We were just outside with Food Truck Tommy, who gave me his after-the-fact picks. Of course, he went 4-0. Then same tomorrow, it's going to be a little bit of sunshine near 70. Wednesday, it's going to get cloudier and then maybe wet weather late in the day. And Thursday could be, we'll have to wait and see on Bob with whether Thursday's a washout. And Friday, mostly sunny, low to mid-70s. I was really fascinated. I give Allison a lot of credit. She writes a lot of interesting stuff for the Hartford Courant. But this story, my wife works at a high school. My three kids are in high school. And so I focus a lot on education and stuff with teenagers. And the story is Connecticut schools using new technology to crack down on vaping. It catches kids when adults not there. And, you know, it's sort of like, you know, the eye in the sky is watching, you know. But at the same time, there's so much focus on technology in terms of phones that we don't really focus on, you know, the issue of vaping, which is, you know, like it's the modern day smoking, right? So I got a bunch of questions for Allison. She joins us here on Brian and Company. Allison, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. Thank you.
Well, first of all, just for perspective, like, and again, like vaping, how big a problem is it in our schools here in Connecticut or nationally? I don't know what sort of data you have.
Yeah, so it's really been a huge problem. Between 2010 and 2019, vaping really took off. It hit its peak in 2019, and then there was kind of a drop during the pandemic. But just last school year, every single year, there's a school health survey called the Youth Risk Behavioral Survey. And the results from last school year, 28% of all high school students in Connecticut had vaped at least once in their life. So it's a huge issue, but kind of another really big problem is students reporting secondhand vaping. And about 35% of students said that they had breathed in someone else's nicotine vape or smoke or THC within the week of taking the survey. So that's okay. Even more that are impacted by it.
So that brings up my follow-up question was whether it's THC or nicotine. But let me take a step back before I ask you that question. Secondhand, like the vapors from vaping, there is a secondhand element. I thought it was part of it was to like it didn't do that. But like there is a negative impact of secondary inhalation of vape fumes?
To be honest, I didn't ask the doctor that I spoke to about secondhand vape and the effect, but it's really just something that students talk about happening within bathrooms, within locker rooms.
They smell it. They basically smell it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it more THC than nicotine? I mean, because there's a qualitative difference, I think, in people's interpretation. If people are all getting high on THC, it's a little different than, I mean, nicotine's still negative, but it seems to me there's a perception difference. Do we know how much is being done of which one?
We don't know how much within schools, but we do know the schools that have installed these vape detectors. For example, Bristol was the most recent school, and they said that within 24 hours of switching it on, they had gotten multiple alerts and had recovered devices that were nicotine-only vapes and also vapes with THC.
Right. Okay. So we're talking with Allison Cross of the Hartford Courant. So what is this technology? What does it actually do?
Yeah. So it's really fascinating. It looks just like a smoke detector, essentially. But it uses machine learning algorithms and a lot of data points to essentially differentiate between what's in the air. So it can pick up on vapor, it can pick up on smoke, and it can also differentiate between nicotine and THC. Founder of the company who I spoke to described it as a smoke detector on steroids. It's kind of much more sensitive than a regular smoke detector. But as soon as it picks up the substance in the air, it sends a direct alert either through email or text to school administrators, school resource officers, anyone that's kind of programmed to accept that message. So then the school can kind of go into the bathrooms and see what's happening and take action if needed.
And this is in, you said it was put in Bristol?
Yes, it's been put in Bristol, and six other districts have used this specific company. There might be other schools that have picked up other devices that are on the market, but some of the other schools were Naugatuck, North Canaan, Norwalk, Sterling, and Windham.
And they're happy with the results and what it's doing?
It was kind of interesting because not many schools wanted to talk to me for this story. I don't know if part of the issue is that they don't want to draw attention to something negative that might be happening in their schools.
Right.
But I do know from speaking to the founder of the company, he said that schools are very happy with the results and principals will send them kind of pictures of all the vapes that they have collected through the technology. And they said that kind of from their estimates, from the data points that they get from the sensors, there's typically like a 70 to up to 85% reduction in vaping once the devices are installed.
We're talking with Allison Cross of the Hartford Current. If you want to read the piece or anything else she's worked on, you just go to current.com. I mean, do you have a sense? Do you know how much roughly it costs to get this stuff put in?
I don't have a sense, but I do know that there are a couple federal grants that you can qualify for air quality and a couple other things. So I know schools kind of across the country were using sometimes COVID money, sometimes other grants to help pay for it.
And my last question is there a sense that that more schools are going to do this?
That is to be decided. You know, obviously vaping, there was a steep drop after the pandemic in terms of the number of students that are vaping, but it is a persistent problem and something that it's really hard for students once they start to quit. I know even the Department of Public Health was kind of emphasizing that vape sensors, you know, they're not the cure-all. You know, right. They're one way to tackle the problem, but you really got to work with prevention and all kinds of education and other methods to make sure that students don't start vaping in the first place.
It's a really good piece. I mean, I at this point in my life, like if I can learn something from something, I didn't know anything about it. So thank you. Nice work, Allison.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Allison Cross from the Hartford Current joining us here. Again, she's got a bunch of other stuff she's written on, but I didn't know that they could do that, and I didn't know that there were Connecticut schools doing that. And I think that it is kind of invasive, right, because it's right in the bathroom. What do they do? Like they get a notification, they run down to the bathroom and bust the kid? Like it's a weird dynamic, but at the same time, we know how unhealthy that stuff is. So, I mean, you got to have rules. I mean, it's the old smoke. I thought we were going to bump in with, like, I like the Motley Crue version, you know, of smoking in the boys' room. But
Beetlejuice pulls in the bucks at the box office.
Here's a preview. Be warned. It's intense.
It's a three-peat for Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. The Tim Burton sequel topped the box office charts once again for a third straight weekend, taking another $26 million, bringing its domestic total to more than $226 million for a film that cost $90 million to make.
The juice is loose.
In second place, the animated new release Transformers 1 with $25
million. It's time to fight back.
Third place went to James McAvoy's horror Speak No Evil.
Oh no, that is really bad luck.
With The Wild Robot being released this Friday, we'll see if Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice can hang on to its lead.
Feel free to express yourself. Don't be afraid.
Cooper Lawrence, CBS News.
It's not going to get me to the theater.
Yeah, I saw it once when the first one, what was it, 87, 88?
Something like that.
Yeah, and I'm good.
I said last week, I love Michael Keaton, and I guess when it's on streaming, I'll take a look at it maybe, but It's doing, I mean, for a movie like that to have a $90 million budget and actually make a profit in this era,
yeah,
it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
Thanks, John. We'll go, and it, you know, Rotten Tomatoes, I mean, it's got a 77, and then The Fan is 81. So that, I mean, those are pretty good numbers. I'm always fascinated, you know, I'm in my early 50s now, and, you know, retirement, I don't really want to retire, at least until I have to. I like having a job and working, and I need to have a job and I need to work. But, you know, I've long, and, you know, I'm not, you're not hearing this the first time probably, but I've been saying it for years and years. My generation, most people in my generation, unless you're a cop or a teacher, are not going to have a pension. Whereas my dad's generation, a large percentage of people had pensions. And so that's just a fact. Except 401ks, you know, they're supposed to be, you know, something that would sort of replace it. And almost everybody in this country is underinvested in their 401ks, and a huge percentage aren't invested at all, which means they become almost solely dependent in retirement on Social Security, which, and so that changes the whole nature of what Social Security is supposed to be. It's supposed to sort of complement what you have going on, but for a lot of people, it is it. And so I was just looking at something on CNBC. Basically, it calculates if you earn $80,000 a year and want to retire at 67 with $1.5 million, this is what you need to save every month. Now, if you started at, you know, 21 is a huge difference between starting at 21 and starting at 30. But say, for instance, you get 5% annual return on the investment, you need to save at least $1,000 a month from the age of 30 to 67. I mean, and so basically that tells you that if you have a 401k and you make $80,000, you better maximize it. Say you get a 50-cent on the dollar match to 6%. Well, you can get a good portion of that funded by your company. Now, we don't even have that right now. So, I mean, and I've never worked for a company that didn't have it until now. But the difference is huge related to, if you had a 5% return when you're 21, you only have to save $700 a month. So the earlier you start, the easier it is. And I didn't have a job with benefits until I was 26. So I couldn't start when I was 21 because I didn't have any opportunity to put something in a 401k. But I'm telling you, we've been maybe a little too, you know, my sons are a little more spendy than my daughter, but my daughter has put away every dollar basically she's ever made as in jobs, and she probably has more cash on hand than we do right now. And I had to check my statements because in the first month of the school year, she still was putting some stuff on our credit card, and she has her own credit card now. We're going to be borrowing money from her. But I do think that with my kids, we've been very, very clear to them. And they opened up, the second they got jobs, they got Roth IRAs because they're not going to, like, I'm not going to pass away and give them a gajillion dollars. And so I figured if I started a Roth IRA when they were, like, very young, that by the time they were old enough, it could be significant. And that's, you can use that with, you know, that's already paid, that's after-tax money, so you don't have to pay tax when you pull it out, as long as you pull it out when you're supposed to. So, but if not a lot of people can save that much money a month, so the sooner you can start, that's what you should tell your kids, the better. All right, coming up at 8:50, Greg Bordinaro, excuse me, and we're going to talk about, there were actually some job losses, I think, last month in Connecticut. What that means, New Haven's really tried to be a biotech hub, and it's not working out great. We'll get an update on that. CRDA, their head, Michael Freemuth, is stepping away after a while, so he's retiring. So what does that mean for the Redevelopment Authority? And there's like a $100 million project in Enfield that's coming, and we'll get some details on that in terms of adding some housing capacity here in Connecticut. Right now, we'll take a break here at 8:44.
Broadcasting from the Johnson Brunetti Studios, this is Brian and Company on WTIC News Talk 1080.
All right, let's take a look at that forecast. Today and tomorrow are going to be basically carbon copies. Although I shouldn't say that because no one knows what a carbon copy is. They're going to be the same. Partly sunny near 70. It was pretty nice out when we went and saw Tommy this morning. Same tomorrow. Wednesday, it's going to be cloudier, maybe some rain in the PM. 65 to 70 on Wednesday. And then it could be a wet, I don't know if it's a washout, but it's a wet day on Thursday. And then it'll get a little bit of sunshine and dry up on Friday. A little early to look to the weekend.
Would the new term be screenshot?
I don't know. I got to think about that. It is making a copy of it. That's not a bad one. Not a bad one. We'll control C. What do we have? Are we taking it to the top or? Okay. Let's bring in Greg Bordenero and take the Connecticut Business Blend.
And now, the Connecticut Business Blend with the Hartford Business Journal on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Greg, good morning. How are you?
Good, Brian. How are you?
I'm good. I'm hanging in there. So Connecticut, I saw that. We had job losses last month. Is that what happened?
Yeah. So Connecticut had going into this year, we had 6 months of consecutive job gains. That was actually snapped in July. There's a couple of news tidbits here. So the Labor Department revised its job totals for July, which was originally a gain of about 700 jobs. Instead, they marked that down to loss of 900 jobs. And then on top of that, the state lost about 2,200 jobs in August. So, Connecticut had gone for a while with job gains, but now we're starting to see the negative territory. We don't know if this is going to be, a broader trend that happens in the next coming months, or if it signals some sort of recession. It does probably indicate that some layoffs are happening at companies. I mean, layoffs are always happening, but maybe there's an uptick in it. The bigger issue is, and the unemployment rate is still very low at 3.4%. Actually, our unemployment rate dropped last month, and the national rate is 4.2%. So Connecticut is faring good in that respect, but one of the issues is the labor shortage. It's still persisting. In fact, the Labor Department has, identified manufacturing had job losses in the quarter, not because of layoffs or firings. It's because manufacturers aren't keeping up with the pace of retirement of their workers. So that's really a critical issue for Connecticut. We know there's been a lot of talk about workforce development, but, this is where it really has an impact on the economy.
Yeah, I mean, listen, if we've always been slow growth, at least, of late, but that kind of job loss kind of implies no growth, right? I mean, I'm not saying we're going to be in a state recession. We talked with Jill Schlesinger earlier. A lot of economists still don't necessarily see it nationally, but clearly, like even with a 0.5% rate cut, I mean, there's some nervousness out there for the broader economy.
Yeah, overall, Connecticut has gained 12,800 jobs for the year, so we're still in plus territory there. And last year, I think we gained about 16,000 to 18,000 jobs overall. So the performance, it's not, I wouldn't call it groundbreaking or epic, but, we have slow growth has sort of been the phrase that I've used to describe Connecticut's economy. But, if we start to go in that negative territory for several consecutive quarters, then, I think we'll have to keep an eye on that and where it heads from there.
Greg Bordenero with the Hartford Business Journal, of course, the Connecticut Business Blend every Monday at 8:50 here on WTIC. So we've talked a lot, I think, in the past about how sort of New Haven wants to be kind of a biotech hub, and it seems like maybe it's not working out so well.
Yeah, I think they have developed a small hub. I think sometimes when we talk about it, it's just, it's this big thing that could compete with, Boston and MIT and Harvard. We're definitely not there yet. And the bigger picture is, lack of growth in bioscience in New Haven, actually, in terms of a jobs perspective. I gave the statistics before, but since 2001, Connecticut has actually lost 13% of its bioscience jobs. Wow. And again, a lot of it comes with the risks of the industry itself. All these are, bioscience companies, what they're doing is they're experimenting with drugs. And when they find out that these drugs don't work or they're not as effective or investor interest, tapers down, that automatically leads to sort of layoffs and downsizing. And that's what you're seeing at a couple of companies. We talked about Sanofi, which bought Protein Sciences a few years ago. They announced they're pulling out of the Connecticut market. And then another company, BioXcel, they recently announced that they did a 28% workforce reduction within their company. They had about 54 employees. It was a second layoff in 2 years. They cut about 50% of their workforce last year. They have several drug candidates. They're basically shrinking their portfolio, and they're going to be focusing on 1 to 2 drug candidates. That one is a treatment for agitation associated with Alzheimer's disease. So it's just just goes to show you these are high risk endeavors. Also, venture funding over the last couple of years has gone down significantly across the U.S. And venture funding is sort of the lifeline for bioscience companies. Right. They need this capital because they're not generating a lot of revenue, or sometimes not even generating any revenue for the first 5 to 10 years as they try to bring these drugs to market, which takes a long time and it's expensive.
But I do like the model in the sense that you have all this brain power and innovation coming out of Yale that you would want to keep some of that here, you know, to make it a good environment. And that's kind of what, isn't that kind of what they're trying to do? Is it to make it a place where Yale, they can start their businesses here and maybe some will stay here and succeed here?
Yeah, and Yale has significantly ramped up its efforts in terms of, you know, commercializing its research. I think the overall the future is bright, but in terms of the bioscience industry sort of becoming this, you know, 10,000 a year new jobs type of industry, I don't see that anytime soon. And, you know, again, because the ebbs and flows of the industry. Also, again, the venture capital funding is the lifeblood. Connecticut doesn't have a lot of venture capital funding in the state. You know, Connecticut Innovations, which is a quasi-public agency, they help back a lot of Connecticut startups and bioscience companies. But you really need some of those other venture funds that are in Boston and even, you know, California to come to Connecticut and invest in these companies.
You know, before we get into the impact of Michael Freemuth, I think maybe a lot of people listening don't know what CRDA is. Can you just, what do they do?
Sure. The Capital Region Development Authority was established in 2012 under the Malloy administration. And basically what they do is they subsidize apartment housing, mostly market rate apartments with a small bit of affordable units mixed in there. And they've been really a key catalyst in helping convert old dilapidated office buildings in downtown Hartford into new housing and also new ground up development. All that development happening around the baseball stadium, that's all helped financed by CRDA. And what they do is kind of provide a gap financing. So, you know, a traditional bank probably would not finance all these deals in Hartford because right. The risk is too high. Right. And a lot of that's based on what you could get back for rents. And, you know, building market rate apartments is expensive in any city, particularly Hartford. What CRDA has done is it's put that little gap, low interest gap financing to help sort of get developers over the hump. And their model has been really successful. They've, under Mike Freemuth's leadership, they've added over 3,300 apartments and there's 2,500 more in the pipeline. Hartford was mostly known as a corporate office park for, you know, decades. They were behind the curve in terms of housing. CRDA has helped jumpstart some of that apartment housing, which is more necessary now than ever because of fewer workers in the office on a regular basis.
So he's retiring. Do we know if anyone's who's going to be his replacement?
No, they're going to be searching. So he's retiring next June. So he did give them lots of a long leadway to that. So they're going to be beginning a search for his replacement. You know, he wanted to stay on. Mike wanted to stay on until the Excel Center funding renovation was in place and ready to move forward. He spent years trying to get the Excel Center situation straightened out. You know, whether you agree or disagree with that investment in the facility, he's been pushing for an update to the Excel Center. He says it's necessary. So now that funding is officially sort of, gone through, and they'll probably start construction by the time he steps down, and then he could have his sort of successor take over from there. So that's kind of the strategy.
Got it. Greg Bordenaro from the Hartford Business Journal joining us here on, of course, the Connecticut Business Blend on Mondays at 8:50 on WTIC. Enfield, $100 million, what's a go-to?
Yeah, so they're looking at a private development, $100 million riverfront development along the Connecticut River. It would be a several-phase development that would add over 300 apartments over time, commercial, retail space. But there's a couple of interesting things. It would be located near a new train station that's being built there that'll connect the Hartford line. So it's an example of that transit-oriented development that the state's been pushing to have apartments near a train that people can hop on to go to work or right. wherever else they need to go. It's going to be redeveloping of a sort of a brownfield, an old manufacturing site, another key area for Connecticut, and also a waterfront development, which, you know, for the most part, Connecticut has underutilized the Connecticut River and its waterfront development there. You know, Hartford basically doesn't have any sort of real commercial development along the waterfront. It has been a focus, so they're going to this is the plan there, a nice waterfront property, mostly market rate apartments. And, you know, it will require probably significant state backing. They're already looking for a $4 million brownfield remediation grant and probably more funding throughout that. And Enfield has a couple other big projects in the pipeline, too. You know, the mall redevelopment there is still sort of in process, which will also require, you know, a lot of state backing to move that forward as well.
Yeah, the mall. Oof, that's sad. Greg, thanks so much. Great job, as always. Appreciate it.
All right. Yep, thanks.
All right, Greg Bordenaro from the Hartford Business Journal. Again, you go to hartfordbusiness.com. A lot of really interesting content on a regular basis. And they were talking about there's also a big renovation going to happen at the Aviation Museum up in Windsor Locks, and that place is awesome. I love that place. I mean, people don't know what they have inside those hangars. They have so many cool things, the history of Sikorsky and everything else, and they're going to get a little reno. Listen, have a great day out there. Enjoy yourselves. Coming up on 9 o'clock, John Silva, have your headlines. And then Brian Kilmeade comes next here on WTIC.